I got a story for everything. That's what I claim. So I got a story for the square root of negative 1. I'm not kidding. So a few years ago, my boys that are in the same grade are in math. So this would have been 4th or 5th grade over at St. Al's. And they're doing square roots of numbers. And of course, I'm helping them. And of course, they have to keep all their equal signs lined up. And there's a way you do mathematics and they can count in Al's. So anyways, they get to 1 and they've got the square root of negative 4. And Matt writes down, can't be done. And Joey writes it down. And Joey likes this stuff. So I go, Joey, maybe not. You know, you got the square root of negative 4 there. Let's think about that. Let's make something up. Let's make up this thing called I, in which I squared is negative 1. Then I can write this as the second root of 4i squared. So what is it? He goes, it's 2 times I. And I go, right. See, I can do it. And Matt looks over and says, Dad, you can't just make crap up. And I said, no, but you're missing the... And I was saying to Matt, I go, Matt, actually, I can. I did. I just did. That's pretty much... I can make crap up. And that's what I do as a mathematical physicist, I think. So I was wanted to talk about physics and beauty. And... I had an idea for this talk I was telling Dr. Alfino just as we were starting, and I kind of threw it out during my workout today, because I think I was going too quick as to just what the beauty was, and I think it's better to think about what it isn't. So the first way I notice, and this would be important, I think, in the discussion with respect to physics, is distinguishing nature from physics. I suppose we could argue whether nature is beautiful or not, but if we give that it is, we wouldn't want to confuse an appreciation of the beauty in nature with an appreciation of the beauty in physics. And that seems like maybe an obvious thing to do, but if you look at the writings of Einstein and his writings about this, he confuses this very obviously. He talks about the beauties of the theories and what the theories are explaining, and I think he mixes those two beauties up. But it's clear to me that I could have a discussion of the beauty of nature and not know anything about science, assuming that that beauty exists. So that's one way I don't have it. Another way that I see an issue is with respect to elegance and beauty. I don't know how to spell elegance, so I'm just going to keep writing. I think that might be right. So, Vesta and I talked like very briefly about, you know, the topic and stuff, and I'm going to go ahead and disagree with her on a bunch of points. And the first would be the issue of elegance. And elegance is important in physics. It's not necessary, but it certainly is appreciated. And a very good example of that is the work done in the 1800s with respect to electric and magnetic phenomenon. What you had was you had a whole bunch of different guys studying things like, and I'll just list some things up, circuits, forces between magnets, the structure of an atom, actually, you know, attraction between positive and negative things, how a current can cause a magnetic field. And all these guys are looking at little sections of it. And then this guy named Maxwell came along and in an impressive treatise brings it all together. He is able to explain through his modeling all of the phenomenon. So he has in this modeling a way to explain things that we normally would think have nothing to do with each other, like an attraction of a proton and an electron, and why magnets repel. The problem with his work is nobody could really understand what it was. He had this kind of odd way to think about what was going on at the atomic level. People didn't agree that atoms existed at the time, but it was properly predictive. So a group of guys got together who knew Maxwell and really made it part of their careers to try to figure out what the heck it was he just did. And historians call these guys the Maxwellians. There's a book called The Maxwellians, which I would recommend, though it's, you know, it does a good job of talking about the challenges, etc. It's really, even for a discussion of developing a theory in physics, this is a particularly dry book. But what they do, though, is show how these, and the number varied over the decade or so these guys worked at this, and they were working on it full time. This 5 to 10 men worked on this, realized that they could formulate Maxwell's ideas in a much more concise way. They were able to get it down to four equations that matched other frameworks. So now we've got Maxwell's four equations. And how they get to there becomes elegant. Maxwell's was a train wreck. I mean, it's all these different ideas with these complicated ideas of this fluid he just makes up, moving all over the place, but he gets the right answer. These guys bring this together in this simpler way, this certainly more elegant way. And this is impressive. So starting from these four equations, and I won't write them down. But starting with these four equations, what you get is anything you want that has to do with electrical or magnetic phenomenon. So we think about that for a second. Yeah, it explains what's going on in the light bulb. It explains the light coming off of the light bulb and the structure of that light. I can start with these four equations. It explains what's going on in an electric circuit. It explains what's going on as a fundamental force of the attraction between a proton and an electron and a hydrogen atom. It explains why magnets repel. Anything that is anything like electricity, anything to do with electricity, magnetism, I can start from these four and get there. It does some other things, too, that are impressive associated with relativity, but we'll skip that. So that's a lot. And so we would like this as a starting point and a form because of simplicity, but also the elegance of the arguments that get there. Once you reformulate Maxwell's ideas in this new form of mathematics, it comes together a lot nicer. And that's really what they did. They said, you know, if we did it this way, and we follow his ideas, everything comes out a lot nicer, and everybody can follow along with what's going on. But I don't think that's beauty. It's like we talked about it, but we actually, honestly, we didn't. I'm thinking here, I like the simplicity. Oh, I got to write down the equations. Here we go. Because I want to talk about the symmetry, too. When I was in graduate school, I started to give talks to local grade schools and general audiences. And a professor I admired, who was very good at this, told me, for every equation you write on the board, you lose the attention of half your audience. So I'm going to try to whittle it down to two here, I think. So... So these are Maxwell's equations. Lasota's following along, making sure I'm doing this right. The place I always mess these up is the sign on the curl of the magnetic field. I always want to put a negative sign in here. Nope, I think I'm good. I'm happy with this. So these triangles mean something in math. But the point is, what the big thing you got here is you got these E's and B's in here. These are electric and magnetic fields. And notice there is a kind of symmetry here. I've got, this is called the divergence of E is how I would read this. Right? So the divergence of E is this. The divergence of B is different. The curl of E, well, it's got that partial B with respect to T here. The curl of B, whoops, I did do it wrong. This is an E. Now I want to look again. Yeah, I'm okay with this. This is good now, right? Okay. So, but there is a kind of symmetry to these, that the way I treat the E and the B is kind of the same as down here. And the difference between them has to do with particular aspects of electrical things versus magnetic things. But there is a kind of symmetry here, and there really is... a simplicity here, and it may not look simple to people without the mathematics, as I don't think the fundamental theorem of calculus does, but once you have that stuff, you look at this and go, well, this is a piece of cake. This is about as easy as it gets in differential calculus. It really is. But I don't think that's beauty. And I don't, and I'm not sure about in mathematics. As you were talking about, I was thinking about it. But I'm confident this is not beauty in the physics, because it's like an assumption that physicists have when they're doing stuff. So what do physicists do, right? Theorist. What they do is they see something going on and they go, well, you know, that's interesting. I wonder if I could come up with a model to explain what's going on. And so they come up with a model. And there's lots of different kinds of models, but typically in physics, you have a theoretical model. This would be an example of a theoretical model. And then what do I do with that model? Well, from that model, I get particular predictions. It's going to say something about the way the world is going to act. And then the science is pretty simple. I have experimentalists, the other kind of scientists. They go out, measure the world, they take data, and I see, does their data match my predictions or not? If the data matches the predictions, I go, good. I have a really good model. I'm happy with my model. But there's some rules when coming up for these models. There is absolutely no justification for this at all. But the fact is, if a theorist is working on a model and it starts to get complicated, he quits with having no idea whether the predictions will match the model or not. He stops. This happened to me several times in my dissertation work. We were trying to do a particular thing associated with scattering of particles, and I'm going through doing it. It's getting messy, and my advisor says, forget it. You can throw it away. You got to do something else. This is no good. You're never going to get it down to something nice. Quit. Why can't it be 13 pages of equations that tell me how E and B work? No. Because we decide that's not what we're going to do. We've decided that the models are going to be simple. And if they're symmetric, that's even better, because then the math is really easy to do, right? And there's actually a lot of symmetry in these, the way these are written. So that's why they have things. That's why when you see physicists having models, they draw lots of spheres, right? Lots of symmetry, really simple. So we always pretend everything's a sphere the first time we go out. It's the easiest thing to do. And if it works, good model. So what does that give you in the end? What it gives you in physics is it gives you these models that have, because of the way you do it, simplicity and symmetry. But again, I don't think that's beauty. I agree it's pretty. They are very pretty. And the derivations can be elegant. But I think there's another way to get to what could be beautiful. And we can get a clue as to that. And it's hidden kind of in the Maxwell stuff. But we can include that with a famous story associated with Richard Feynman. Oh, another spelling problem. I don't know how many N's are in this man's name. Okay, the two at the end? All right. I got Maxwell's equations right the second time, though. So Feynman, no, that's not right. It's this. Well, yeah, but when you say two ends in a name, it's the ones next to each other with soda. Quit yanking me around. Right, okay, so that's right. Okay, so Feynman was, the story was when he was in graduate school working on his dissertation, he was working I hadn't thought about how to say this simply. He was looking at how an electron moves through space under particular conditions. And there were problems with this at the time in modeling, and they couldn't really figure out what was going on. And the story was, every day at lunch, he would go to the university cafeteria, sit there and have something. And then one day, he started to play with his plate. So I brought a demo. I didn't think of this till this morning, so this is the best I got. I just got a roll of tape, and I'm going to put black marks around it. I hope this works. And then what I'm going to do is show you what Feynman saw with his plate. So on his plate was an emblem of the university, right? And so what I do is I'm going to roll this thing around. And what we're noticing is two different things. The rate, which is very rapid, that the edge of contact moves around versus the rate that the black marks move around. They're different, right? And Feynman notices that, right? What he's seeing for the plate, and you could see, you know, do this when you get home, the image of express one here, it moves around a lot slower than the edges going around, right? The contact edge is going real fast. You know, it's this thing like this, right? So the edge contact is moving a lot faster than the black line is moving around. So Feynman looks at that and he goes, well, that's cool. They don't move around the same. I wonder if there's a relationship between them. So he grabbed a stack of napkins, borrowed a pen, and of course worked out the physics of it. And noticed that when it got at very large angles and very small angles, the equations simplified enormously. And he thought that was really cool. So he takes a stack of napkins back and took a plate with him, shows it to his advisor and says, you know, look at this. His advisor looks down and says, what are you doing? You're supposed to be working on your dissertation. We got to get some progress on this. And Feynman wrote about how disappointed he was because he thought, this is what physicists do, right? And so he goes back to his work. He starts looking at the equations and he realizes, oh my God, the equation of this thing at very small angles is the equation I need to explain the electron moving through space. And he creates electrodynamics. So you could see he was lucky, but no, the guy like this is going to find this kind of stuff anyways. I mean, this is why he's a genius, and I'm explaining what he does with tape and marker. Right? So, but the point here is, though, I would point here, what is unusual about this is in starting to get us to our beauty is, what the heck does a plate have to do with electrons? I mean, maybe I imagine that charges have something to do with magnetic fields, but plates don't have anything to do with electrons. So now there's a sense of what I think of as beauty in this example from Feynman. I think what beauty is, and this is my general definition, is a harmony of contrast. This is what I mean when I say my wife is beautiful. I think my wife is pretty, too. It's not symmetry and simplicity. It's another kind of pretty. But I also think she's beautiful. And I think I'm able to say that unlike anyone else because I know her really well. I know her better than anybody else. I might know her better than she does after 23 years of marriage. And I know about those inner conflicts and things she has to work out. And I know how she's brought them together in this person and how she deals with them. And that would be the harmony of that contrast. And the person we would think about this as conflict or challenge. Well, not in physics, right? So in physics, what is it? Well, I think we see the beauty in the physics and there's two ways people talk about this. They talk about the theory of everything. Oh, I'm not even going to write that down. The theory of everything, and that's not an accident. We call it TOE. Or the other way it's shown up, this is the more recent way to think of it. It's also these grand unified theories. So we have guts. It's like we got no imagination. So, but what's the theory of everything? We should think about that kind of in the context of Maxwell's work, talking about things that we might not think have anything to do with each other but are close, and maybe more importantly, Feynman with his plate and his electron. If a true theory of everything exists, people like Letterman argue that we should be able to write down a single equation and that's it. That's what physics is after, is that ultimate equation analogous to Maxwell's four equations that I start from there and I've got everything. Wow. So that means the theory of everything would do stuff like explain black holes, which aren't science fiction. We have overwhelming experimental evidence that black holes exist. The evaporation of water. A hydrogen atom. Or why is the sunset red? Actually, these two are kind of close. You don't know that, so it's okay. So the sunset being red, the hydrogen, all these things, if there is this theory of everything, well, there's that harmony, right? And this is when we particularly like a theory of physics, in which it doesn't just do a modeling of some system, but it generalizes in some way, that it models many things. And I think that's where you can see the beauty. I'm, frankly, unconvinced that this thing exists. Now, I have to very quickly say people a lot smarter than me, and we can hit a long list of that, think it does, right? Hawking, everybody that does general relativity I know of, think that this is completely reasonable. But I guess I would point to a historical pattern of natural scientists or physicists saying, we're pretty much done. All we got is these little details to work out, and it's over. We've got all the physics explained, right? And then a couple experiments come up, and they go, you know, oh, crap. And then somebody comes up with relativity and quantum mechanics, or realizes the hydrogen atom does not look like the solar system. Doesn't really act like the solar system, and realize there's a problem. And it feels to me like we're at that place again. We're saying, okay, yeah, I know there's this problem with gravity, but I think we can figure that out, and we'll have a theory of everything. And of course, maybe I'm like anti-beauty or something, but I hope they don't. I hope they find a couple of experiments and it just blows the thing to pieces. And they're like, oh man, we don't know what's going on, right? Because it gives us all something to do. But I think that's what I would argue for here. And what I'm trying to do here is, I think, kind of the opposite direction of Vesta. I had this, coming into this, I had this idea of beauty. I really hadn't thought, frankly, I hadn't thought about it in terms of physics, because I usually don't think of, I think of physics as just simple or elegant. But this is my more general idea, and I think in these kind of theories that bring a lot of things together, I think there might be a chance for something like beauty. That's all I got. Well, but that would be the physical model then, right? Feynman could have his, it would have some bizarre name. I mean, he could have called it not just electrodynamics, he could have called it electrodynamics and rotating plates and submitted that paper. The point is, it was kind of generalizes, right? So I have this model that explains things that aren't just a single system. It's not just the electron moving through space. Now, in that case, it doesn't generalize like I would want a theory of everything to, right? But it's the kind of thing that makes you, that I sometimes find very startling in physics. It's not just a mathematical technique. There were, the way he was keeping track of particular physical quantities were the same in each explanation. It wasn't just that he used Volterra equations of the second kind in both ones. It was the relationship between the physical quantities.
I mean, I did find a point of comparison between your talks that you might, I mean, you kind of presented some of the differences, but it seemed like both of you were very interested in surprising in ways that in ways that we find unity in surprising ways from multiplicity. So for you it was the idea of generalizing and finding a harmony of what of things that seemed to be very different. And you expressed this also, you know. So I wonder if you feel like that is I'm kind of trying to locate the agreement and disagreement in your approaches. I mean, you do have different approaches, but that seemed to be a point of agreement.
I would think in mathematics, I guess the first place I would look for, I mean, you can see it in the equations, but I think the easiest place would be in geometry, right? And so I always think I have a choice. I can do my math with the equations, or, God forbid, I can draw a picture and do the geometry associated with it. And so I think it's when you have those similar geometries that you start to see it in mathematics. and there's reasons that you would have the same kind of structures in different mathematical explanations. But in physics, I think it's kind of, I don't know why you would think there's a theory of everything. Right? In mathematics, I would think, well, yeah, I would think that these, I would gain an intuition that this would be like this because of particular mathematical characteristics. But I don't know why I would expect a single theory to explain black holes in evaporation of water. My intuition would be just the opposite, that actually is something just hoped for. On the mathematical one, I think it's more expected.
But I think you can also look at very, very, you know, within mathematics, there's areas of mathematics that appear to be completely unrelated. So not just in terms of, you know, something like the fundamental theorem of calculus, but entire huge theories. You know, you have a plate over here, and you have stuff about, I don't know all the words, electrons over here, and they don't look anything alike, and they're not built in any way the same, and they're mathematically, clearly, obviously, completely different, and yet people find connections between them. And
well, but I think more of my point would be, like, if, you know, you did the Pythagorean theorem. What if you thought about the proof of Fermat's last theorem, right? I mean, it's hideous by any
means. Right.
Well, right, Fermat's last theorem is that you do a variation on the Pythagorean theorem. Right? So if you have twos in here for the ends, then you can find integers for x, y, and z. So Fermat's last theorem says, what if I put a 3 in here or a 4? Can you find integers? And Fermat said, no. But nobody's ever proven it until what? Like 5-6 years ago or something.
Oh, no, more than that. Oh,
geez.
Just lost track of time.
I don't know. 22 years ago.
93, 97.
Here, so anyway, but the point is that the proof of this is really complicated. And it's just not like it's long. It uses lots of mathematics that very few people understand, actually. There are parts of this proof in which you, I don't know, I would guess that maybe would the math department as a whole here be able to go through this proof? No. So that's a problem. So the question is, do you think, though, no, seriously, it's some hairy stuff. And so the question is, though, do you think, though, that there is that elegant proof? Because I suspect there is. It's why I still do it. Even when I gave up. God, was it that long ago, 93? But anyway, for a long time, I didn't have anything to do on Sunday afternoon. I tried to prove Fermat's last theorem because I had nothing else to do. Right? And my thinking was, you know, maybe there's something easy, I'll hit it, you know. And it was kind of fun. I hear some new piece of mathematics or think of something, and I try it. Right? And it never worked, of course, obviously. But I thought there was a simple way to do it. In a statement made that simply, I would hope I have an elegant proof.
So I'm a little confused now because when you're talking about, like, you didn't think elegance was beauty, I thought of Paul Erdős and his proofs from the book, you know, like, which, you know, if you found this proof from the book for that thing, that would be this, you know, elegant proof that was insightful and brief and all this. But you said you didn't think elegance was beauty, and you want to pursue it.
Well, I don't just pursue things that are beautiful, right? I think that this is, the proof that exists for this is ugly, and because I see so often in mathematics elegant explanations, I just feel, and that's the only thing I can use, that there's an elegant proof of this.
So I still have a problem, because to Andrew Wiles, who proved Fermat's last theorem, I don't think it was ugly. And if you have the opportunity to watch him, listen to him, talk about it, there's a moment when he makes a connection between things that are completely different. And you can see at that moment that he is seeing something that is, to him, incredibly beautiful. That I can't understand it doesn't make it not beautiful. Or does it?
Well, I wouldn't even argue that it's beautiful. I'm just talking about, I would still argue for elegance. I'm not sure I would say, I'm just saying that I think this, there's reasons in mathematics to think that you expect to have simplicity in explanation. You expect to have symmetry in solution. It's because of the way you construct the mathematics. I mean, it's a construction of people, right? You're not undergoing discovery in nature. Mathematics is a construction.
Not necessarily. I mean, this is an argument.
Dear.
A lot of mathematicians argue that they're discovering something, constructing something. So that's not settled.
I mean, what are you discovering?
Let's table that one.
Okay. Because I'm about to ask Percy the way to play those forms right now.
You find beauty in simplicity and elegance for you. So, I always thought of Einstein's theory of relativity, the E equals MC squared, as being simple and elegant and beautiful. I don't know. What are your thoughts? Is there, an elegant proof for that? Is there, I don't know.
It actually is. That's one of the hallmarks, I think, of Einstein's work, is he explained, in several cases, unexplained phenomenon. Brownian motion, why things move the way they do at the atomic scale. The photoelectric effect, which was completely unexplained, and he develops relativity. He does it with high school algebra. I'm not exaggerating. His explanation of Brownian motion, the extremely complicated mathematical concept you need for Brownian motion, is the average. If you understand what an average is, you can follow his explanation. And for a photoelectric effect, if you understand y equals mx plus b, equation of a line, that's it. That's the tough part. And for relativity, his first thing when explaining space and time, you got to be able to take a square root, solve for x, take a square root, then you're fine. I mean, it just pissed me off. It really does. But I wouldn't argue that's... I'm not saying that elegance is beauty. I actually would distinguish elegance from beauty. I think that elegance tends to have simplicity and symmetry with it, but I don't think that's beauty.
That equation's not beauty?
No, I don't think it's beautiful. I would say it's simple. I would say the derivation of it, the explanation of it, is really elegant. It's part of Einstein's genius. But I just don't think that matches beauty for me. I need...
Because there's no harmony coming.
Right. I need to learn something about the components, the way they're presented, that I didn't have another way. There isn't an insight given into an elegant derivation. You still have the same result. But when I see something that's beautiful, I think I don't just see the harmony of these contrasting elements, the thing I'm going to come back to. I actually learned something about the elements in that case. If you've ever been to Western Oregon, right, you can find places, and there's several places, and I said, well, it's flat, right? I don't think that's beautiful. It's simple. It's very simple. It's got a huge amount of symmetry. But I do not think that constitutes beauty, because there is nothing that is brought... There is no contrast. And that is what I think of. And the way I get there isn't by saying that that is... I don't just come up with that definition. The way I agree with that is the argument here is that generally agreed upon things that are beautiful, people get to that definition of the harmony of contrast. Particular types of landscapes, particular types of poetry, particular types of people.
What drives you to do math? Seems pretty clear what drives your...
Well, actually, I'm much more a mathematician than a physicist. My dissertation was a proof about particular equations. It really had very little application in the real world. But I just proved some things. And I think what I like about mathematics is I just find it very enjoyable to do. I get this weird look every time I teach the engineers, in 103, 204, I tell them this, and they look at me like I got lobsters coming out of my ears. But one of my favorite things to do is I have a collection of what's called the temple problems. It is a collection of geometry problems from across Japan that were posted in temples, and I don't remember how many are. There's a ton of them. And they're very interesting because they don't look like Western geometry problems. They tend to focus on spheres and planes next to spheres. And I just really enjoy sitting and trying to prove these temple problems. I find it pleasant. It makes me happy. No, and that, but that's
consider
it.
Consider enjoying beauty.
What?
You wouldn't consider enjoying something as a degree of beauty?
you got pleasure and beauty on the table now. That's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I can certainly take pleasure in things that aren't beautiful. Right? That's certainly true. I like cheeseburgers, but I don't think of a cheeseburger in any sense as a beautiful thing.
Do you want to answer the question?
Well, I don't know the answer to your question. I'm going to have to... You gave me something to think about this. Because it's different. When you're doing the math, there's a particular depth of understanding. There's the way that it's experienced. I'll have to think about that. I don't know.
I have a question about, you were talking about sort of the philosophy of science as coming up with models that describe predictions, and you talk about the example of Feynman, that one model can make predictions about two different sort of things. Well, what would you say about, like, if two models could equally well describe one phenomenon, does that add
to it? And that really gets to an important point. There are several historical examples of competing models that give the exact same predictions, and physicists pick the simpler one. That's it. Now, there's a rationale there. Why would you go with the more complicated one if they give the same results? Because you're only interested in predictions matching data. There isn't... A good scientist doesn't say, is the model real or true? No. That's not what science does. Science just says, if I do this, I predict what's going to happen and matches data, then I'm happy. And so if the simpler one gave the same predictions as the more complicated one, why would I ever use a more complicated? Scientific models aren't reality. Physicists don't, right? This is the little picture you get. You got, how do you do this? You got the real world. You got the models. Those experimentalist types. Man, there's stories of why I am not an experimentalist. From the models, you get predictions. You do not compare the models to the real world. What you do is you do this comparison, and you say, do these match? And if they do, then you say, yay, I have what's called a good theory, right? A theory is saying that this model will make appropriate predictions about parts of the real world. But I never think my model's real. Think of a model you know isn't. You go into Hughes and they've got these tinker toy models of a molecule, and they'll say it. They'll actually use language like this. This is a sugar molecule. And I'm like, I know it isn't. It's wood and spring. Right? And that's not what they mean. They mean if I think of the sugar molecule as having this orientation, I'll predict things about a sugar molecule that match the data. Same thing with Maxwell's equations. I don't believe that those equations exist in ultimate reality. But if I use them, I can make predictions that match the data, the measurements of reality. So I'm always going to go with simple. And there's no justification for that, other than why would you, if you're only interested in the predictions, why would you do something more complicated?
You don't have an inductive basis for saying that historically more productive results have come from simpler theories, or the simpler theories had more. Maybe you couldn't say that.
No, I don't think you really. I don't think you can do that, because the more complicated one got dumped and nobody's using it. Right. There's actually a lot of cases of that. Yeah.
What if you had two models, one simpler and one more complex, that give equally accurate predictions for one class of phenomena? But the more complex model gives predictions for a wider class of phenomena.
Well, but I would like that one. Now, it depends what I was doing. If I was just looking at the common class, then I would use the simpler model. But I wouldn't say that is my best model, right? If one is more general, then I would prefer that. Because that's one thing I like, right? I'm it's this idea of trying to get to this theory of everything. That's getting me closer to the theory of everything. Actually, there is a historical example where, and I think this is, I don't think this is particularly good science, right? The Copernican model had the is a replacement for Earth-centered models, and the Copernican model is heliocentric, and the original one of them gave horrible predictions, and Copernicus gets stuck with it because he decided just a couple observations under the old model couldn't be right. If you have the Earth-centered model of the Ptolemaic model, the size of the moon in the sky needs to vary a lot, and it doesn't. And it won't under Copernicus's model, and Copernicus convinced himself that every Earth-centered model has that problem, so it can't be right. Yeah, but Copernicus does a terrible job of finding Mars, Jupiter, you know, all these things. It's much worse than everything else. And I think that's an example of bad science. You should have stuck with the Ptolemaic model. It did a great job of finding Mars and all the planets in the sky. As good as any model we have now. So I got the moon wrong. Eh, what do you want? It's got one little thing, one little problem. And you're like,
so, one, do others have questions? So, if there's no theory of everything, would you say the universe is not beautiful?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no cause.
I just need to think about it for a while.
I'll go,
yeah, sure. It's not ultimately beautiful.
Yeah,
I guess
that's
I would.
Fine. Doesn't have to be.
Right.
Okay.
Because there are senses in which I see, I mean, the Earth as this thing that has a biomass on it and everything. I can think about that as having a kind of beauty. But I wouldn't.
Wouldn't be everything.
Yeah. I'm not sure about that because I could appreciate the universe in a way that wasn't via physical theory. Right? I appreciate when I think of the Earth that way. So I wouldn't think of it as scientifically beautiful.
Yeah, your
physics theory beautiful. If there's no theory of everything.
If you had an understanding of the universe that harmonized it at some level, that might still make it your
right.
Understanding.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, you can. I assume we've all seen landscapes that we've been struck by and thought how beautiful they were. We don't have to know anything about geology or plant or botany to understand. Appreciate the beauty of that landscape. Yeah.
If you are going to make a decision on whether the universe is beautiful or not based on whether or not there's a theory of everything, aren't you in some sense reifying your models?
Am I what?
Like, I mean, if
you're comparing a model to reality, which is what you don't.
Yeah,
you don't
like,
want
I
to
mean,
do.
If you're going to. If. If you're going to make a judgment...
You're right. I shouldn't have... You're right. You're right. I shouldn't have said that. I should have said, I don't know anything about the universe. I'm talking about models.
Yeah.
You're right. That's what I should have said. Yeah, I should have said, what does that have to do with...
Right.
But again, personally, I think that it's not... And there's a lot written on this, even in the general literature about this theory of everything. And I might be out on the edge a little bit on this, but I just don't buy it. I mean, there's a lot of big egos that want to be the ones that find it. I mean... Hawking's writing on this is just terrible, the way he talks about it. He basically says he's got it. And, you know, I'm from Missouri, show me. And then we'll talk. But he really doesn't. There's some serious problems. And I'm thinking of it a lot like around 1900. There were four or five experiments that just weren't working, and we needed quantum mechanics and relativity to explain what was going on there. And there's several experiments now that just really look bad to me. It just doesn't look right. So I'm hoping.
Yeah, right. Everybody's got a bet.
Train wreck. Good.
Good discussion. Some other questions?
I had a question about mathematics and kind of the field of knowledge. I once heard the knowledge about mathematics can kind of be described as a cloud that's expanding. We're getting, you know, theory for this, knowledge about that. And I was going to ask kind of your opinion about, you know, how big that cloud is now and if there's holes in it. Where are we going in mathematics now?
I guess, you know, so first off, understand that I don't consider myself knowledgeable about a lot of mathematics. So I know some things. But there's way more that I don't know. But it feels to me like that's a good analogy, that it's an expanding cloud. But I have no belief that it would stop expanding, that there's sort of an end to that. Because we are creative people, and we'll keep thinking of new things to think about. Every time you think, okay, we know it all, well, same thing in physics. Something new gets realized or thought about, or somebody finds a hole in something, and to patch that hole you need to build this, more mathematics, more stuff. And in some sense, the, Fermat's last theorem there is an example of that. So people tried to prove this. Well, tried with simple methods, and it didn't work. And kept having to expand and build new mathematics to try to get at this one simple little equation. And it's unbelievable the weight of mathematics needed then to prove that thing. And I have, I think I would be quite arrogant to say that I would think that there's an end to that. There's certainly, if you were to, sort of look at the pile of what is known, there's certainly holes in it, and which I would think of as areas of mathematics that, aren't completely known, even before you get kind of out to the edge of, the most complicated stuff you could possibly think of. I mean, there's undergraduates thinking of new things in mathematics that weren't known. So you don't necessarily have to be sort of at the very far edge of sort of research. Does that answer your question in some way?
Yes.
There's a saying that, as you go through school and learn mathematics, you realize that you know less and less. There's more out there than you don't know.
So would you think it's a safe bet that there will be new fields in mathematics in the next 20 years?
Oh, sure.
There have been in the last 20 years. So it won't just be filling in.
No, I don't think so. I mean, other mathematicians in the room, am I far off, or do you agree?
Yeah.
I agree with you. And also, too, another thing is to be discovered or connections.
Right.
That sounds like filling in, but maybe not.
I don't think so. Sometimes those connections end up being whole fields, yeah.
I don't want to go back to the other topic if people want to stay on this, but doesn't that seem to tilt towards conventionalism in mathematics? I mean, if the possibility of creating ever new fields sounds more like we're making it up, some of it's useful, rather than we're discovering it. Because you can imagine if it's discovery, you kind of get to the end of it. There's only so many things to discover. But it's a big topic.
I guess I wouldn't agree that there's, if it is discovery, there's necessarily an end to it. I mean,
I'd have a problem with that philosophically. Yeah, if it's actually discovery, I think it needs to be that means discovering means you're finding out things about reality. And reality has to be finite in every measure. I would argue against infinities being a possibility in reality. Now, I don't have a problem with the potential of mathematics being infinite because I don't believe it's about reality. Honestly, my little story at the beginning is, I think you just make crap up.
Exactly.
Right, but if you just make crap up, you're not discovering anything. That's not what discovery is, I would say.
Yeah, I guess I'm not so worried about whether it's discovery or creating. But
I mean, that distinction is important for his question.
Okay.
If it's creative, then you understand the boundlessness in a different way than if it's discovery.
But what's the difference then with the square root of -1? So somebody says, let's call that I.
Right.
And they make up a bunch of stuff that seems to work internally, and yet then it's realized that that's describing something about reality. So
yeah,
was that a creation or a discovery?
No, you didn't discover anything about reality. You created a tool that helps you represent a model that will give you predictions that match data.
So that would indicate
But it isn't, and there's nothing in there that's real.
No mathematics is discovered.
I would say not. I think
real.
It's a creative process.
Fine with me.
And I would argue the experience of it is a creative process even.
Yeah.
that it feels creative as opposed to typical types of discovery.
I guess I need to check this generalization I made, because we were in a philosophy colloquy a month ago, or 6 weeks ago, and I made this claim that's an empirical claim that you can help me verify. And I had been talking to some of the mathematicians here, but maybe it's not a good sample. And I said, I thought most mathematicians today were conventionalists rather than realists, which is a way of saying that they make it up. And some of it turns out to be useful, but as opposed to being a realist like a Plotin is. Then would you say, is it easy to say that most mathematicians are or aren't realists? Or?
I don't know.
Yeah? Okay.
There's a quote that I don't know who said it, but there's a quote I've heard that says most mathematicians are Platonists during the week and constructivists on Sundays.
That's great. That's great.
Well, you act like it is real. I'm not saying, certainly even when physicists talk about...
it feels real when you do it.
Well, it does. And when physicists talk about their model, I say things like, you know, this is the electron. But I don't mean that. I don't mean that there is lines of a magnetic field around a magnet. I don't mean that. I use that language. And I think mathematicians, I think that's what that quote is saying, is that they act like it is. Well, of course you would. It makes it easy to manipulate. Why be confused about the reality of the thing when you're just manipulating it mathematically? The same with physics. It's like the chemist saying, this is a sugar molecule. It's not.
Don't we kind of have to, as physicists, sheepishly admit that we make it all up too?
Yeah, we do. But we at least compare it to reality at some point. A mathematician can have
compare it to data for reality.
What?
You compare it to data for
reality. Right. You make predictions and compare it to the data, right? There is a mathematician could have a successful career and never have an application to anything.
Right, but probably at some point somebody is going to make that material.
But he has no intent of application while in his work.
Half of us, yes.
Yeah.
Correct.
There would be no reason to think about what this has to do with anything. And that's one of the reasons I like it. There's absolutely no, it's what's fantastic about math. There's no restrictions. You can do whatever you want. As long as you do it well and do it nicely and do it elegantly, right? You can really get somewhere.
Well, guys, this was really nice. Thank you, Vesta. Thank you, Eric. And thanks for coming. You can stick around and talk a little more if you'd like. Let's show some appreciation to our panelists again.
Compare the rules to reality. Yeah, I can't know that. I can just know that the